Accession number 30624, reel 4.
Accession number 30624, Mr. Murray Pevan, reel 4. Now, tell me how you got to Canada then. What was it?
Well, we got in this gigantic boat at Gourock.
Do you know which one?
Well, let me come to this. It's a bit of a joke. We all got on this boat, and we thought, well, it's a big boat. It's a bit small to go across the Atlantic, but it was the tender. And then we came here, and then a wall of steel. A wall of steel. And we looked up and up and up and up and up and up. It was the bloody Queen Mary. And we went up. No, sorry, I beg your pardon. No, it wasn't. It was the Empress of Scotland. I do beg your pardon. The Empress of Scotland. But it was a wall of steel, you know, like a building. And we went in, and we went into this boat. And they took us down and down and down and down. And right in the very depths, there was this, I can only describe it as a hangar. And it had these bunks, 1, 2, 3, vertically. And that was where we were for the next, I think, 10 days or something like that. And it made an unescorted dash from Gourock to Halifax, Nova Scotia.
So you weren't in Conway, you were just going for
on
speed.
Its own, it went, and it was zigzagging the whole time. And it was winter time, I think.
No, August.
August was
looked
out.
Up. Well, you were at the 31 PDC till August.
Yeah, that's right, August.
Now, it can appear like winter in the Atlantic,
well,
I believe.
Well, they went far north, you see.
Now, were you seasick? Because a lot of people are.
Well, we only got two meals a day. Breakfast, and the worst part of it all was the toilet arrangements. Because the head was in a sort of a thing, a gigantic space with all the toilets and all the... the accumulated mass of liquids from hundreds and hundreds of lads was sloshing from one side to the other. Left your legs that slosh by. And most of the guys stayed dressed, and I thought, well, if we're going to go down, we're going to go down. So I wore pyjamas.
But were you seasick?
I wasn't seasick, but a lot of the guys were.
And what do you remember of the voyage? I mean,
nothing, Murray. It's just that I'd never experienced anything like it in my life. We were allowed up on the decks during the day, one of the decks, and there's this sea wind and the rushing waves and orders and instructions and wearing your life jackets all the time, overcoat on, your hat on, pulled down so it won't blow off. And that was it, two meals a day. A second meal was always sausage and mash, something like that. Because you're on a boat, and there are hundreds of you. But the greatest part was coming into harbour in Halifax. Brilliant lights! Hadn't seen lights. And we pulled up alongside, and every single person rushed to one side of the boat to look over at this dock, and the boat heeled over. And we were there with the guards patrolling underneath, Canadians. And somehow we all started throwing money at these people, you know. And then we stayed on overnight, and the next day we were put on a train. And this was a Canadian train, which is like an American train. And at the back, the very back carriage, was this sort of place where you could stand and wave to people, that you could see on films. And this train, what we didn't realise, it was a wood burner. And it was going along at about 25 miles an hour. And we went to Moncton, New Brunswick. And that's where we went to our next camp.
Now, would that be the 33 element? Oh, no. Hang on. Is that... there's a base there at Moncton. I'm not sure whether it's here or not. Let me pass it to you so you can have a look.
Let me tell you which one it is.
Because I know there is a camp at Moncton.
Wait a minute. PD.
I don't think it's on there, is it?
No, wait a minute.
It's not there.
No. My next station was 33 AFTS, which was Moose Jaw, Canada. So it's not it, no.
Now, what were you doing at Moncton? Just waiting,
apparently. Just waiting. It was a very civilised place. We were given Canadian-type kit there, which included Canadian tropical uniform, which is like American uniforms. We all put... very proud of those. And the great thing about, we could go into town and order food in restaurants, steaks with bananas. still got it. For a dollar.
It's a restaurant.
You can buy sunglasses. You could buy anything you wanted. And loads of people with cars used to take you home for supper. It was a brilliant place. It was like peacetime there.
So it was pretty comfortable.
Oh, yes. And it was the first time in my life I'd ever had a shower. I'd never known what a shower was. And I said to somebody, you get in the shower, do you need soap as well? If it's just the second shower in the day because it's so hot? Of course you do.
Now tell me about the hospitality. You say they were
Canadians are wonderful. Canadians are wonderful.
So what would they do for you when you went?
Basically, not so much there because it was so concentrated. But if you went to shops, they were nice to you. People were nice, but they'd seen hundreds of thousands of you. But later on, when we went to a place...
Okay, we'll pick that up later. Yeah. So your next posting is to 33 Elementary Flying Training School at Moose Jaw?
Canada, yeah.
And which state? In
Saskatchewan. And that involved a four-day train ride.
Now, what was that like?
That was unbelievable because there was no road across Canada in those days. And the train went part of the way through America to get from east to west. It went through the state of Maine. So we stop at the first station, and there you were in the USA. And there the people came out, and they were giving you chocolate and sweets and bananas and things. Hiya, you know. And we couldn't believe it. We are in America! Me! From the east end of London. And it was just unbelievable. And then the train went on, chugging along. And we got blacker and blacker as the smoke came back through the carriages. But they had carriages where you went in and they had full washing arrangements and things like that. And we stopped at different stations and endless prairie and all that sort of thing. And then we finally got to Cairns, Saskatchewan, which was an elementary flying station, which was operated by a civilian flying school, Boundary Bay Flying School. But it was all Air Force discipline. And there we encountered a very advanced trainer called the Cornell, Fairchild Cornell.
Now, what did you think of the Cornell? I'm not familiar with that one.
It looked like a Spitfire to me for the first time. It was very similar to a Chipmunk, which most people are familiar with today.
And what was it like? I mean,
it was a low-wing monoplane with a fared-in seating arrangement. It looked sleek, it looked streamlined to me. It looked hot, and they were deadly serious about your training from then on.
Now, can I talk a bit about your instructor? Because you seem to be with Flight Sergeant Marley. Do you remember him as an instructor?
No, I can't remember any of them.
What did you think of them as instructors?
Because they were gods. They were gods. They were gods. Flight Sergeant Harley. And here we had to write down what the exercise was, so you can see exactly what it was. Familiarity with cockpit layout. Essential. Preparation for flight. Air experience. Effective controls. Taxiing. Straight and level flying. That was my first 35 minutes. And Flight Sergeant Harley had me every day. And by the third thing, we were doing spins.
So he just took you from the start, you through the program you'd already done.
Yeah. He had me until my first solo.
Now, was there anything new you learnt?
Everything. It was another world. The aircraft was so different. So different. It was sophisticated. It had all sorts of things in it. It had performance, had power.
And so you were really enjoying it?
I was loving every moment of it. This was another world. And also, half the time we were flying and half the time we were at ground school. The quality of the training the RAF gave us in the height of the war was unbelievable.
So you were generally... I just looked up and it's August the 24th. Actually, it's your first solo test. Yeah. First solo is on August 24th. Right.
Yeah.
Now, What do you remember of your first solo? I mean,
you're shit scared. You've got to do it right. You know they're watching you from the tower because they got binoculars on you and you're doing a circuit. How long did it last? Can you see there?
Let me have a look at...
the first solo.
30.
30 minutes?
No, 20. 20.
20 minutes.
Yeah, 20 minutes, sorry.
What have we got there? Just got the first solo, that's all.
Yeah. 20 minutes. It doesn't say anything else about it, yeah.
20 minutes is about right, yeah. By the time he taxi out, you see there's... you're not on a runway. There's aircraft taking landing all over the place. And what you have to do is wait your turn and seize a chance to get off. And then when you're coming in, seize your chance to come in.
And, was it a big moment for you? I mean, how important was it to you?
To me, it was the most important day of my life. I mean, all this work and effort that had gone into getting me there, and if I'd noised it now, I was straight off to air gunner school. No messing about. I mean, there was no... no, it was a very hard-nosed situation. There was a war on.
Now, after that, you start flying on your own. You still have Flight Sergeant Harley.
Yes. It's a progressive thing.
But you know, you're in the left-hand column, the pilot of first column, as often as you are in the right-hand after that.
Well, that's when it's getting good.
Now, you start learning more complex manoeuvres, don't you? I mean,
all set out there. I can't remember.
Oh, no, I'll just ask you about some of them, you know.
Yeah.
For instance, it talks about sidestepping. Now, I don't think they're allowed to do that now either. Can you tell me what's...
I still sideslip, and I'm the only one in the club that sideslips.
Now, tell me about, not now, but sideslipping then. I mean, what does it mean?
Sideslipping, you can use A, to lose height in a hurry. Let me explain something. That's a wing, right?
No, they can't see it.
No. If you have... A wing has got a span, say 36 feet. If you're slipping, you're twisting the aircraft, and so the effective span is reduced. You've got less lift, you're going to come down. So if you want to descend in a hurry, you can achieve it by side-slipping. The other thing is this, if you are coming into land and you can't see over the nose and you want to see get a better view, you can side-slip, which twists the aircraft in its axis, front to back, to one side. If you're flying along, you have a little ball there, which is to one side or the other, or in the center. If it's not in the center, then you're flying badly. In other words, the airplane is not presenting itself straight to the road. It's like skidding on a road. You're going along slightly sideways. And they're slipping and skidding, actually. It's the same thing in the opposite direction. If you slip and you're in a turn, you're slipping inwards, you're skidding outwards. So
now, the other thing, it mentions...
And you've got an indicator there, the old Regent Sigrist, which is still better than the ones they have today, and it shows you with the top needle whether you're slipping or skidding, or whether you're straight, you know, flying straight. And when you're taking off at night in those days, that was the key indicator, because if you slipped or skidded, you're going to go off the runway in darkness, and you had to stick to that.
I'll come back to night flying. I'm going to tell you, as I see new things, I'll just ask you about steep turns. Are steep turns different from...
A steep turn is when the angle of the wing is very, very great. If you turn normally, you're turning at about 15, 20, 25, 30 degrees to the horizontal. Steep turn, 60 degrees, 65 degrees, anything up to 90 degrees. And to achieve a steep turn, obviously, because you're getting less lift from the wing, you have to have more airspeed, and you have to use your rudder, because your controls are changing their function. They're swapping function. A steep turn, an ideal steep turn, is when you do a 360-degree steep turn, and you hit your own wake when you come out of it. Shows you've done it right.
Now, there's lots of... you're doing lots of these things. You start to do navigation exercises.
Yeah,
can you tell me a bit about navigation exercises and the methods you actually use?
Well, navigation, obviously, you've got to get from A to B. Now, there are no signs up in the sky. So you start off with a map on which you draw the required track. Then you measure with a protractor the direction which that track is. Then you also put on your chart the direction of the wind. Then you make a calculation for the effect that that wind's going to have on the time that you're operating that flight. Then you offset your track to take into account the wind effect. And that's called the triangle of velocities. And that's really the simplest way I can describe it.
Now, I know that's what
and
you meant.
And that's the theory. And then you mark out your sort of waypoints all the way along that you're going to be looking for. And the time of how many minutes into your flight you're going to be over them. And then what you flow in elementary navigation is to fly carefully watching the ground. And if you know that you're going to go over a certain river or canal or a bridge or town or what have you, after 10 minutes, you're looking after 8 or 9 minutes to see if you're getting anywhere near it. Now, it should be coming under the nose, but it could be to one side or the other. Now, if it's one side or the other, then you've got to correct your course that you're going to take from then on, because obviously the wind is not behaving as you expected it to. So you recalculate it. And there are ways and means of doing that. 1 in 60 rule is one. But basically, it's map reading, and then bloody well where you are.
Because a lot of early pilots just used to follow the railway lines. Not quite so easy in Canada, and there probably aren't so many about.
Yeah, and one thing about Canada is all the fields were either rectangular, north, south, east and west. But I managed to get hopelessly lost, because they've got millions of lakes there. And the other thing was, if you found a railway line in Canada, we used to cheat. Because as you went along, they used to have these great big grain hoppers there. And they had the name of the town painted on the side of the grain hopper. But night flying, of course you don't.
Night
flying, you can't do that.
Tell me about night flying generally. What are the different things?
Well, night flying was horrifyingly frightening at the first time. So the first off, you're just doing circuits and bumps. And you've got lights to assist you, but working out your angles and speeds and direction for landing is very much different, because you have to use a sort of a sixth sense, when to flare, when to level out, when to hold off, and of course you've got no indication from the ground where you are. In Canada it's just blackness really, just a few lights of the odd farm, etc. So you've got to have a pretty good idea where you're going and how to get back. And I was very lucky. On my solo night cross countries, I never once got lost. I got lost in day cross countries, but never in night cross countries. And even when we were flying Oxfords at the service flying training school later on, and we'd have maybe a 2 or 3 hour cross country solo,
I'll come to it, obviously.
Never got lost.
So night flying was pretty difficult, but
you
didn't have as much trouble as some people, obviously. What about instrument flying?
Flying is another, it's totally different. Let me explain why. If you're flying an aircraft, you have to have, what's the word? You have to have indications which tell you where and how you are. Now you're driving a car, you know damn well, the curb's that side, you've got to keep that side of a centre line, imaginary centre line, halfway between the curbs. And you've got an indicator. Now, suddenly you come to a great big field, and there's nothing on that. And you don't look down. You're going to start curving sooner or later. Now, in an aeroplane, you've got three dimensions. And if you fly into a cloud, as it tells you in that book from CFS, it's impossible for the most skilled aviator to stay straight and level and in the same direction for more than a few minutes before he loses it. It's to do with the cochlea in your ear and all sorts of things, sensory inputs. Without those sensory inputs, you've had it, you've lost. And instrument flying, which was developed just before the war, really, because the instrumentation became available, was the most important part of flying, especially later on if you're in bomber corps flying at night. Without those instruments, you've had it. And today, of course, all flying depends on instruments, because they fly in all weathers.
Now, how would you practice that? I mean, do they just put a hood on you?
Yes, they put a hood on you.
Depending on
the aircraft. Either you wear foggles, or they have a hood, or else they cover up some instruments. But basically, you have to fly in what they call a limited panel. Now, without your turn and bank meter, you've had it. I mean, you can fly on a fewer instruments than the ones you've got. I do that today. I mean, very often fly, maybe they'll say, well, Murray, the artificial horizon is in op or something's in op. It doesn't matter, we can still fly it without, providing we've got a minimum of instruments, airspeed indicator. If you're flying along at this constant throttle setting and your airspeed starts increasing, it means only one thing, you're going down. If your airspeed starts decreasing, it means only one thing, you're going up or you're turning. So basically, if you've got your turn and bank operative and you've got your airspeed and one other thing, and that is your vertical speed indicator, you can fly.
Now, you start on aerobatics eventually.
Yep.
Can you take us through? I mean, it's always popular to know. famous things like the loop.
I wasn't all that good on aerobatics. I think that's why they pushed me onto twins. But aerobatics means performing manoeuvres other than just normal, straight and level, simple turns, climbing and gliding, descending turns.
So, what? About the loop?
A loop is a very simple thing. You push the nose down, you get extra airspeed, then you come back with your stick, lift the nose up and keep going up and up and up, and keep the stick back so that you go over the top and come down the other side. And that's a loop. A roll off the top, you go into a loop, and when you get to the top and you're upside down, roll the aircraft upright and carry on. That's known as an immelman, ex-First World War maneuver. A roll is when you're going along and you roll the aircraft about its fore and aft axis. In other words, you push your stick hard over and the aircraft turns onto its side and keeps turning until it's on its back and then comes up the other side. Various types of roll. Flick roll, which when you go, and a barrel roll where the whole aircraft is going around as well. And
now, which did you have difficulty with?
All of them.
Why do you think that was? Because was it more you were an accurate flyer than a flare pilot? What was it?
No, I was accurate. I just wasn't a born aerobatic pilot.
What do you think makes someone a born? What skill did you have missing?
A good horseman will be a good aerobatic pilot. I could never get on a horse. I'd go straight off the other side. And yet I was a great cyclist. I could do anything on a bike. I don't know why. Maybe I didn't like it. But the thing is this, that we didn't do very much in the way of aerobatics.
You'd got two sessions there. You started quite late into September.
Let me say something. Those who went on to single-engine planes, the Harvard, which they got on before the Spitfires, they did aerobatics all day long. We were going on to Oxford, and the Oxford wasn't aerobatic. So my aerobatic skills and training were very limited.
Now, when was it decided you were going to Oxford?
By the chief flying instructors. Some stage they had to separate you because the EFDS fed both things. So it depended on the bomber command people saying, right, we're going to need more multi-engine pilots, or fighter command saying, right, we're going to need more single-engine pilots.
So you were
decided at high levels, and they came down in targets to the schools. So
you were assessed to be a bomber pilot. I mean,
not to be a bomber, to be
multi-engine, right.
Can I say something? There were 350 different types of aircraft in use in the Air Force. So you can't just categorise everything as the fighters and bombers.
So you were going to be a multi-engine?
There were multi-engine fighters. There were single-engine bombers. Okay, thank you.
Good point. Now,
there were other aircraft in the Air Force other than Spitfires and Lancasters. Put it that way.
Now, did you mind or were you quite pleased?
I was pleased to get my wings, and that's all I wanted.
I thought you were assessed for your multi-engine.
No, you're only assessed for the next stage of training.
Right, okay. So that's the subsequent.
So training was progressive.
Yeah.
They first of all got you to be able to fly an aircraft the Air Force way, right? On your own. Simple task, fly here, fly there, do whatever you want to do, day and night. And once you got through all that, not that we did much night flying at EFDS.
Now, can I ask you about the link training? Because it does crop up.
Yeah, link training went on simultaneously.
Now, what was the link training? Can you explain how it worked?
It was the earliest sort of simulator that they had. There was a table on it, was a piece of metal with three legs with a great big cord attached to gigantic apparatus, and you sat in a miniature imitation of a cockpit of an aircraft. When they pulled the hood over, this thing could gyrate about, following the actions, following the movements of your control input, and this crab would go across on a track on a chart, simulating where you were directing it, and with an ink brush underneath it. Okay.
And how realistic was it for you?
Incredibly realistic, because you've seen these multi-million-pound simulators. You've seen them on TV. You've seen all about them. They teach them the modern pilots on. But they didn't have computers in those days. But basically, they gave you the nearest they could in those days to it. And you could get sick in an ink, if you like. Now, all the link pages were at the back of there.
No, I'm just looking at the other. I'm looking ahead. All right.
Yeah.
So that was all part of the training.
Oh, absolutely.
So you were on the Fairchild. It was the Fairchild Cornell and the link train.
Yeah.
Now, your assessment. Now, you're assessed as average. I'm quite surprised at that.
No, average was good. That's what you wanted to be, average. Very few people got anything more than average. The target was if you got below average, then you started to worry. I was never anything other than average all through my flying career.
But average was fine.
Average was fine. All the pilots in the Air Force were average. And they were all bloody good pilots. Better than me.
Now, so what's the next stage then?
Service flying training.
Now, so you're at 33 EFTS till the 2nd of October, and that's when you're graded. Is that when you got your wings or not yet?
No.
So then you go to 36 service flying training school.
Right.
Now, where was that at?
That was at Penhold, Alberta.
Now, when you got there, this is a 36 service flying training school. What was the setup at?
This was a very large purpose-built airfield. It was a massive airfield, and it was solely RAF training. And it was pouring pilots out day and night.
Now, what about the Oxford? This is to fly the Oxford. And
the Oxford, I've got booklets on.
Now, what was your first impression of the Oxford?
It was a gigantic aircraft. It was a 57-foot wingspan, and it was bigger than anything I'd ever seen before in my life. Now, how the hell can I fly that? It's a cabin. It looks like a DC-3, slightly small, slightly reduced in size. Cabin monoplane, low wing, two enormous wing engines on each, one on each wing, retractable undercarriage.
We still haven't.
Very powerful.
Was it still being wound up by hand,
on a bad day, I had to do it. The people inside, I'd have to wind up if there wasn't an irk. Oh yes, but the Canadians used an electric plug-in, but we had to do it by hand.
What was it like to fly?
It was a wonderful plane. It was a wonderful trainer. It was difficult to fly well. That was designed into it.
And what do you mean?
Well, you didn't want an airplane that was easy to fly, because this is serious combat pilots you're training, and they've got to be able to fly under all circumstances, under all conditions. And it was a difficult plane to fly. But it was an ideal trainer because of that.
Did you find it heavy at the controls after what you'd had before?
Oh yes, it was quite different. It was very much faster. It was getting up to 200 miles an hour. It was heavier, and of course the whole point about it as a trainer was that they concentrate a lot on flying it on one engine only. In other words, what happens if you lose an engine in flight?